I'm Bill Neville with the Entrust Group. Thanks for joining our webinar today on invoice factoring, which is something I'm really excited to have presented to you. It's a topic that, you know, we've been doing these webinars for a number of years, and I think this is the first time that we're going to cover this topic, which is a really interesting way to potentially invest, something that that I think you're going to enjoy. Before we get into that, I'm just going to mention, as we always do, that any presentations that we do are for educational, informational purposes only. We are not advisors. So if you have an interest in investing in this or any other non-traditional investment, make sure that you talk to a CPA or an advisor or a lawyer before making any investment. But note that Entrust does not do any due diligence on any investment that you decide to make within your account with us. So as far as the agenda, I'm going to, before the WHO is the International Factoring Association, I'm going to give you a quick overview about Entrust. And then Tanya Daniel from the International Factoring Association is going to go over, this is the agenda, profile of a factoring client, what exactly is factoring, how the deal structuring works, how does factoring work, and the risks and protections that you can get from it. What to look for in a factor. And then finally, at the end, I'm going to go over how you could do something like this in an IRA. And then we'll take your questions at the end. So if you have any questions, feel free to type them into the box, the question answer box, and we will answer every single question at the end. So, yeah. That's me. I've been with Entrust. Actually, it's coming up on 14 years. My role with the company is to educate people on how they can use their retirement accounts to invest in non-traditional assets. So a non-traditional asset would be anything other than a stock, bond, or mutual fund. So like real estate, private equity, precious metals, et cetera, factoring obviously would be considered a non-traditional investment inside a retirement account. Entrust has been in business since 1981, so for over 40 years. We are what are known as a self-directed retirement account. Custodian and record keeper, administrator is another term to use for it. The majority of us are certified IRA service professionals, and we hold these monthly educational webinars about different topics related to the self-directed IRA field. We currently have about $5 billion under administration. We've had in our history over 45,000 different investors who have used an account with us. We've been in business, as I mentioned, since 1981, so over 40 years. And one of the ways we differentiate ourselves from our competitors that we provide a single point of contact. So for anybody who opens an account with us, you are assigned a team of two people. So I'm one of four business development managers with Entrust. I have an associate. And so if you have any questions or need any assistance, you're not just calling an 800 number, you get a direct point of contact to assist you. All right, let's get to the meat. Let's get to the exciting part of this. Again, I want to introduce Tanya Daniel, who's the president of the International Factoring Association. I just want to mention, I met Tanya last year at their event where we decided to sponsor a table. And boy, was it eye-opening and really enjoyable. And as soon as, like within a very short period of time, I thought to myself, I need to have somebody from this industry come on and do one of our webinars. And so somebody from the group, from the one of the factoring companies introduced me to Tanya, and she was open to this. And so I'm very excited about this. Tanya, you can take it from here. And then I'll pop on at the end to, you know, go over how you can do this inside of self-directed IRAs and then help with the questions.
Great. Thank you, Bill. Thanks for coming to our event earlier this year and for taking an interest in factoring. Factoring is near and dear to my heart. I've been a factor. It's all I've really ever done in my career. I was a member of the IFA before taking the role as executive director. So I really believe in what factors do, and I'm excited to share this information with you. I know Bill's really already went over the agenda, so we could probably move forward. But please, this webinar is for you, so feel free to ask questions. Happy to answer any questions at the end. We are the International Factoring Association, so I'm not here to sell you anything. We're an association. that's dedicated to the factoring industry. We're established in 1999, so we've been doing this for quite a while. We have about 450 corporate members. So those are individual factoring companies. And that's really who you would be investing in, is the factoring company. We're going to talk a lot today about the factoring clients, because that's really the underlying collateral and where the risk lies, is with those factoring clients. But typically, our members are a lot of small or independent businesses themselves. Certainly, we have a lot of bank-owned or institutionally owned members, but a lot of our members are independent, small to medium-sized businesses who typically have traditional bank financing, a line of credit, or they are funded by friends and family. But they're always looking for ways to bring in investors to increase capital. And so I think that's where we'll find that this could be a really good fit for you. Our association really focuses on training, obviously lots of factoring training, advocacy work, education, networking. So we provide all the tools a factor needs to be successful in the industry. The good thing about our members is that they are bound by our code of ethics. And so that just makes a big difference when you are doing business with the factor. You want to make sure that they are a member of the association. So that way, you know that they are dedicated to continuing education and training, but that they're also bound by the code of ethics. And factoring is a huge industry and very, very popular all throughout the world, very common form of financing for businesses in Europe, and definitely a big industry in kind of emerging economies. But in North America, it's been around. It's one of the oldest forms of financing, and so it's a very popular way, becoming more and more popular, and kind of commonplace way for businesses to get the working capital and cash flow that they need. So, who are the factoring clients? And so, when we talk about a factoring client, those are the businesses that our members, the factoring companies, fund. And so, typically, a factoring client is a small to medium-sized business who needs cash flow. They have to make payroll, they need to buy product to fulfill orders. They may be growing. There's a whole lot of different reasons why they need cash flow, but it's typically a product geared towards that small to medium-sized business. Not always, though. There are a lot of larger businesses who look for factoring, especially if they're looking for some sort of off-balance sheet financing option. I had a client a few years ago, one of the largest market research companies in the world. They had traditional financing, but they used factoring as a way to go out and acquire businesses. And since it was an off-balance sheet tool for them, they didn't have to tap into their traditional line of credit, and it worked very well. A factoring client has to have business-to-business receivables. So they have to sell a product or perform a service for another business, because the factor is really underwriting the credit quality of their factoring client's customer. So who are they selling that product to? Who are they performing that service for? That's really where the credit risk lies in a factoring transaction. So they cannot have any consumer receivables that are factored. So this is not for restaurants or hair salons or landscapers who are billing the homeowner. This product really is for a business that is selling a product, performing a service for another business. A lot of times, factoring clients are startups, and so they can't get traditional bank financing. They've not been in business long enough. Sometimes it's that the business has been credit challenged, whether that's the owner of the business has had, may have bankruptcies or poor personal credit, or the business itself has gone through some challenges, which makes it difficult for them to get traditional bank financing. It's not Always, though, and I think it used to be that a lot of people felt that only challenged businesses look to factoring for their financing needs. That's just really not the case. A lot of times it's a business who's growing, but they can't be bound by the financial covenants that a bank puts on them. They need flexibility. So someone who's in growth mode, or it could be someone who is being asked to exit the bank. Maybe they busted some financial covenants, which in this market and coming out of COVID is not a surprise for a lot of businesses. And factoring is very popular, really, amongst almost all B2B industries, but there are some industries where it really stands out, like transportation. A lot of banks won't finance transportation companies, but those transportation companies need cash in order to fuel up their trucks and pay their drivers so they can pick up their next loads. So transportation is a very highly factorable industry. We have many members who specialize only in transportation receivables. But then a lot of service companies like staffing, you think about a staffing company who may be sending nurses out to a hospital, but those nurses expect to get paid every week. But the staffing agency has to wait 30, 60, 90 days or more to get paid by the hospital. A lot of businesses just don't have that 3 or 4 months worth of cash flow built up to start making payroll before they ever get paid on their first invoice. So a lot of service companies like staffing factor. Also, when you think about a traditional bank line of credit, service companies don't have hard assets to pledge. So that typically makes it a little bit more difficult for them to get the bank financing that they need. But then there's manufacturers, distributors, all sorts of industries that factor. Manufacturers, they get a purchase order from their customer. They need to buy product to fill that purchase order. Factoring is a great way to give them that consistent cash flow and working capital to keep things moving. So let's kind of, now we know kind of who looks for factoring, let's talk about really what factoring is and how it's different from a traditional bank loan. Factoring is not a loan. The business is not taking on debt. They're not giving up equity. It is a true sale of an asset. They are selling their accounts receivable to the factor. So we'll use the example and we'll go through kind of in more detail examples, but we use the example of a trucking company. They may have delivered a load today. They have their proof of delivery that they delivered that load. They cannot wait 30, 60, 90 days to get paid because they need the cash to fuel up their truck so they can pick up the next load. They're going to send that rate confirmation sheet, proof of delivery, and invoice to their factor. Their factor is going to buy that invoice from them. It's a literal purchase of an asset. They're going to buy it and then they're going to pay them upfront for that invoice at a discount. So if you think about, Walmart offers their customers a 2% net 10 discount. So they tell them, hey, we'll either pay you in 60 days or we'll pay you in 10 days, but we're going to take a 2% discount. Factoring is very, very similar to that. It's the same sort of concept. A discount is typically taken off of the invoice, and that's the fee that the factor earns. We will go in later to this and to kind of deal structures and different fees that factors charge. But at the root of what factoring is, it's buying that invoice from the factoring client, paying them upfront, and earning a discount on that. There are no financial covenants associated with factoring typically because it is not a loan. And so it really does give the factoring client the flexibility they need, especially when they're growing, because they just don't have to be bound by the financial covenants that a bank would put on them. Factoring really comes in two different forms. There's recourse factoring and non-recourse factoring. So in non-recourse factoring, the factor takes on the credit risk of non-payment from the factoring client's customer, the account debtor. So if there is an event of insolvency, the factor does not go back to their factoring client to collect the money that they advanced them. The factor's taking on that credit risk. In recourse factoring, the factor can go back to their client for repayment if there was an event of insolvency by their customer. So those are the two types of factoring. Non-recourse factoring is popular in certain industries. The garment industry non-recourse has kind of been the standard for many years. But it really just depends on what the factor is willing to do and what the client is looking for. Non-recourse, if you're a factoring client and you're doing business with investment grade account debtors, you don't need a non-recourse line because the chances of your customer filing bankruptcy if their investment grade is low. So there's just no need for it. But those are the two types of factoring that we see the most. And it's just really important to understand in factoring the reason a factor can do business with someone who's not traditionally bankable is because they are underwriting the credit quality of the factoring client's account debtors. So in the trucking company example, if they're hauling loads for Walmart, Walmart's creditworthy, so the factor can extend a line of credit based on Walmart's credit. If they're doing business with ABC shipper and there's no credit information available on them, it's going to make it harder for the factor to provide a line of credit for those receivables. But the factor is looking at the credit quality of the underlying account debtors. That's who's going to repay those advances on the invoices when they pay those invoices in full. So that's where the main difference between a traditional line of credit and factoring lies, is that factors shift that risk to the account debtors. Of course, the credit quality or just understanding your factoring client's business is so very important. You want to understand what it is that they actually do, what product they sell, what could go wrong after they sell that product that could stop someone from paying the invoice. You know, if your factoring client has had losses, you want to understand why. You want to know the story of what got them here. But ultimately, the approval process funding decisions really based on the account debtor's credit quality. It's important to understand that when it's a sale of an asset, like an account receivable, when the factor purchases it, they own that receivable. They now are collecting payment direct from the account debtors, not from their clients. So factors put money into their clients' bank accounts for working capital and cash flow needs. They don't take money out of it unless there was to be, you know, something that really went wrong. But normal course of business, the way a factor gets paid back on their advance of the receivable is that they notify those account debtors that they own those receivables and are factoring them. And when those account debtors pay, they don't pay to the factoring client, they pay to the factor direct. And so that's a key component in factoring, is that the factor owns that receivable and that they collect the payment direct from the account debtors. And we'll get into that in a little bit more detail. Factoring, the reason so many people love it and are interested, it is a little bit riskier than a traditional line of credit or bank loan, but the yields are heftier as well. So typical yields, 18 to 24%, could be much higher, could be lower, but that's really the average. It's important to also understand that in addition to providing the cash flow to the factoring client, a lot of factors also provide back office support and services to them, which is all kind of included in this all-in yield. So when you think about what a factor is doing, they're purchasing that receivable, they're advancing those funds to their factoring client, but now they own and manage that receivable until it pays. And so in some cases, factors are creating invoices for their clients. They're their credit department checking credit on their customers for them. They're posting cash for them since they're collecting the payments direct. They are their accounts receivable department calling the customers and checking payment status. So factoring is more than just here's some money and don't talk to me again. It is a relationship with that factoring client where you're really interacting with them on a regular basis. And the factor partners with their client to help provide them with all of the support they need to be successful. So let's talk a little bit about deal structuring. When a factor gets a prospective factoring client, the things that they are looking at that drive sort of the structure and the different rates and fees that come into play. One of the biggest thing that factors are looking at is dilution on their clients' receivables. So if a factor buys an invoice for $100 and they advance 95%, $95, they want to make sure that on average, when that invoice pays, it's going to pay back at least 95%, if not more. And so the dilution on receivables is one of the most important things that factors look at. You know, there's some industries where discounts are taken often. At a client that sold juice shots into grocery stores, you know, dilution on that tends to be a little bit higher. There could be spoilage or different things where the grocer takes some discounts before they pay those invoices. So in a case like that, the advance rate may be a little bit lower. Something like transportation, you have a rate confirmation sheet. You already know how much you're going to get paid before you deliver that load. Typically, if you deliver the load on time, you're going to get paid in full. So the advance rates can be higher because there's less dilution in that industry. So dilution is a big driver. Typically, factors are not advancing 100% of the invoice value upfront. Typical advance rates range from 80% to 90%. In transportation, on average, it's 95%. But factors always have some sort of reserve account that they hold in order to help offset any sort of dilution, deductions, or things that can happen when the invoice pays. That's one of the very first things factors look at. And clients always want to know what their advance rate is. And so that dilution, figuring that out is key right up front. Obviously, since factors base their funding decisions on the creditworthiness of their clients, customers, or account debtors, checking debtor credit is really the very first thing that's done in an underwriting process. If a client has very creditworthy account debtors, then there's going to be more flexibility in the deal structure, more flexibility in the rates. If they have mid-range credit, you know, maybe private companies or, you know, just account debtors where there's not a whole lot of information available, but they can still approve credit for those customers, then, you know, the structure may be a little bit tighter, rates may be a little bit higher because there's just not as much published, public credit information available on those debtors. So debtor credit is the key to the entire factoring relationship. And along with debtor credit comes concentration risk. So if you have a client, a factoring client who does business with 100 different account debtors or customers, and one of those customers doesn't pay, well, you have 99 other customers that should be paying, and you have that reserve account that can help offset the non-payment risk of that one that didn't pay. But if you have a client that only does business with one customer or account debtor, then that risk is much higher if that customer doesn't pay their invoice. So concentration risk and debtor credit go hand in hand. The more customers a client has, the more flexibility there can typically be in the deal structure. the less customers they have, the riskier the deal. So the less flexibility or the higher the rates. Obviously, since a factor is relying on the account debtors to repay the invoices, looking at historical aging performance is extremely important. You want to look and see, how do these customers normally pay these invoices? Do they normally pay them in 60 days? Or does it take them 180 days to pay? Do they normally skip invoices, or do they pay them all when due? Do they take discounts or deductions, or do they have to wait until they get paid to make a payment? So looking at the historical performance of those account debtors with that client is one of the key elements that a factor looks at when structuring a deal. Contra accounts are where your factoring client maybe owes money to their customer. They may be doing business with each other. There may be some element of remarketing fees or something that are due. But if your client could potentially owe money to their customer, that's something that factors pay close attention to, because that could mean that that customer or account debtor would maybe offset what your client owes when they make that payment, which could be a risk to the factor. The invoicing process in general, really understanding what your factoring client does, so you can identify as the factor what can go wrong in that process. So it's really important that a factor just learns about their client's industry, which for me personally was always one of the best things about factoring, is that I got to learn so much about so many different industries. But it's more than just, oh, you have credit-worthy account debtors. You really want to understand the process, the invoicing process, when they invoice, what could go wrong from the time they invoice to the time the customer pays. So really diving into that piece of understanding your client is important. And then also a factor wants to see who their guarantor could be on the in the factoring relationship. So the factor typically gets either personal guarantees or validity guarantees from the majority owners of the business. And sometimes those guarantees aren't quite worth the piece of paper that they're written on. Those guarantors may not have a whole lot of creditworthiness to them or a whole lot of assets to help make the factor whole if something were to happen. But what it does do is a factor wants to know that their client, that the ownership of their client is as committed to the business as they're asking the factor to be. And so getting some sort of guarantor, even if it's a validity guarantor, which means that they're only responsible to repay the factor in the event of a loss if there was fraud. But no matter what, there's going to be some sort of guarantor, and the strength of that guarantor helps with the deal structuring. So kind of looking at all of that, amongst other things, but that's really the core of what a factor's looking at when they're deciding on whether or not they're going to bring on a client, what advance rate they're going to give them, and what terms they're going to give them. And that's kind of that other side when we talk about rates and fees. As I mentioned in the last slide, kind of a flat discount rate, a 2% discount when they buy the invoice. That's a very typical sort of rate structure that a factor has. But there's other fees or rates that are considered. Sometimes they're combined. So there's, excuse me, multiple different sorts of rates within the same relationship. Sometimes it's based on, when an invoice pays. So it may be 2% at the time the factor buys the invoice. But once the invoice reaches 30 days, there's another quarter of a point. And once it reaches 60 days, there's another quarter of a point. So It's not uncommon for there to be kind of these back-end periodic fees so that the factoring client pays the factor more the longer the invoice is out there. And I've heard from prospects in the past, well, oh, okay, if you're going to earn more money the longer the invoice is out there, Mr. Factor, you're not going to try and collect that invoice as quickly as you can because you want to earn more. It's not at all the case. The key for factoring is that those receivables are turning as quickly as possible. There's no factor out there that wants to delay receiving repayment of an invoice just to earn another, 25 basis points. In some cases, it's a kind of same concept, but more done as a rebate where the factor may charge more upfront in a discount, let's say 3% instead of 2%. But then if the invoice pays in 60 days, they rebate a portion of that back to the client. So same concept as the periodic rate, but just done a little differently. And then in a lot of cases, in addition to a discount, there could be some sort of interest charge based on the funds in use. So there's kind of two different numbers to keep in mind. There's the invoice value. So the factor may be buying a $1,000 invoice, but if they're advancing 90%, then they have $900 in funds in use or funds employed, and the interest is charged on that funds in use amount, where typically the discount is charged on the invoice amount. So lots of different ways to structure deals. Some of it depends on industry and transportation. A flat rate discount is really the way to go. In more sophisticated businesses, they prefer something that's maybe more interest or funds in use driven so they can control how much cash they actually take on in advance and help control how much they're paying the factor. There's also fees that factors charge. Certainly, most factors are going to charge a client some sort of due diligence fee upfront just to cover their costs for searches and all of that sort of stuff. But then it's not uncommon for a factor to have minimums in their agreements with their factoring clients, where they say, Mr. Client, you've got to factor $1 million a month in invoices. And if you don't, then there's some sort of fee. And that's usually comes into play when a client is very rate sensitive and they're trying to get the best rate possible. A factor will want to know that in exchange for providing this lower rate, that they're going to get a certain volume. So minimums are very common, sometimes processing fees. So there's a lot of factors who actually create the invoices for their clients. And again, that's very common in transportation, where a lot of transportation owners of transportation companies are also driving trucks, their owner operators. So they don't have a big back office. They don't have a big accounting department. So the factor really is serving as their true back office. And so processing fees are not uncommon. Misdirected payment fees, and we'll talk more about misdirected payments when we talk about the different risks associated with factoring. But there is certainly a very big penalty if a factoring client accepts the payment from their customer and deposits it, doesn't send it to the factor. There's some fees associated with that. And then if a client looks to terminate their agreement with the factor early, there's typically early termination fees tied to that. Okay, so we've talked a lot about who a factoring client is, kind of how it works, but we're going to dig into that a little bit deeper now. So I said it earlier, but to reiterate, a factoring client is business to business. They sell a product, they perform a service for another business. They're doing that. They cannot wait the 30, 60, 90 days to get paid, so they partner with a factor. When that factoring client is going to take on a new customer or they're going to factor a customer's invoices for the first time, they're going to submit that customer or account debtor to the factor for credit approval. factors are typically not going to take invoices for customers that they've not been able to already credit approve. So the factoring client submits that account debtor for credit approval. The factor gets back to that client to tell them how much of a credit line they can extend to that customer. The factoring client can then submit their invoices and supporting backup documentation to the factor for funding. That supporting backup documentation is very important. If you are a staffing agency, that supporting backup is probably timesheets. If you're a trucking company, the supporting documentation is going to be a proof of delivery. You know, if it's a manufacturing company, it may be a purchase order as well as proof of delivery. But a factor wants not just the invoice, not a spreadsheet that lists the invoices. They want to see the actual invoice and the supporting backup documentation, because they're relying on that invoice to be paid in full in order to get their money back. So when the client submits the invoices and the supporting backup documentation to the factor, before the factor is going to purchase in advance against that invoice, they're going to audit that backup documentation to the invoice. So for example, if the factoring client is invoicing their customer for 100 widgets at $1 a piece, but the purchase order says 50 widgets at $1 a piece, there's something wrong there. Or if the price is different, or if the purchase order says that the widgets need to be delivered to Birmingham, Alabama, but the proof of delivery says that the widgets were delivered to San Diego, California, the factor's looking at all of that before they even buy the invoice. Because if there is a discrepancy in that invoice that could hold it up from being repaid, the factor either is going to try and work with their client to resolve that discrepancy, or they're not going to buy that invoice. In a lot of cases, beyond just auditing the backup documentation, the factor is going to reach out to that account debtor to confirm the validity of the invoice. So a lot of customers or account debtors now have portals. So it could be that the factor logs into a portal. We've used Walmart as an example. You log into Walmart's portal and you can see that they've approved these invoices for your factoring client. It shows the amount they've approved. You know those invoices are good. You're okay to go ahead and purchase and advance them against them. But in a lot of cases, it's calling a customer and saying, hey, did you get the widgets? And is everything okay with them? And are you going to pay them when they're due? But there's a lot that goes into kind of touching and feeling and confirming the validity of those invoices before a dollar goes out on them. So once a factor audits that backup documentation and confirms the validity of the invoice direct with that account debtor, then typically the factor is going to buy the invoice. And I'll say a lot of that kind of auditing and confirming of the invoice happens very quickly. The majority of factors will fund their clients the same day that they submitted invoice. Not always. There's some invoices that take longer or some factors that don't commit to same day funding, but typically the process is very, very quick. But once that's done, the factor buys the invoice. They pay that predetermined advance rate upfront, typically 80 to 90% of the invoice value. They're going to wire or ACH those funds into the client's operating bank account. So they now have the cash flow they need to make payroll, buy more product, whatever the case is. Since they didn't advance 100%, the factor is kind of keeping that reserve account to help cover any sort of dilution that happens, deductions that could happen when the invoice pays. The factor then manages the collection of that receivable. Part of managing that receivable is notifying the account debtor that the factor owns the receivables and that payments must go to the factor. Factors typically have a lockbox established with their bank that all payments from account debtors go into for all of their clients. They don't set up separate lockboxes for each client. It all goes into one lockbox, but those payments go direct to the factor. Sometimes a factor will take dominion over a client's existing bank account, but in any case, the factor is always going to manage the collection of that receivable and almost always notify the account debtor that they own the receivable and that payments need to come to them. But the factor will manage that collection. So if it's 30-day terms and now that invoice is 38 days old, the factor is going to reach out to that account debtor, call accounts payable, and check payment status on that invoice. So they're actively managing those receivables. It's not done in a kind of collection agency sort of way, because factors certainly are very sensitive to the fact that their clients, that those are their clients' customers. And if a factor is out there disrupting that relationship, it could impact the factor's ability to keep their clients. But nonetheless, the factor is going to manage the collection of that receivable. If during that collection process it comes to light that there's some sort of issue with the invoice, the factor will typically go back to their client, work with their client to help resolve that issue. And then once the invoice pays, it pays to the factor direct. The factor keeps the amount they advance, that 80 to 90%. That's usually where they're then deducting fees and then remitting the remaining reserve balance direct to their client. So there are a fair amount of risks in factoring, as you can imagine. Typically we are dealing with small to mid-sized businesses. Typically they are businesses who maybe can't get traditional bank financing. So there are risks associated. Some of them are very obvious, like fraudulent invoices, right? It's not hard for someone to create an invoice for 1,000 widgets when it really should have only been for 800, or to invoice at $1.50 a widget instead of $1.25, right? Or to sometimes just submit totally fake invoices. But that is a very common risk in factoring, that factors really know how to offset that risk. A lot of that is done through that kind of document audit phase and an invoice confirmation or verification phase. Certainly, though, one of the risks that exists in factoring. I talked earlier about misdirected payment fees. So misdirected payments, again, the factor has already paid their client for that invoice. So now the way the factor gets repaid is by getting payment direct from the account debtor. It's happened where factoring clients go to their customer and say, "Hey, I know the factor told you to pay them direct. I'm not doing business with them anymore. Pay me instead." Or they go and they pick up a check and they don't deliver it to the factor. Or their customer pays them by accident instead of the factor, and they decide not to tell the factor they got paid. So misdirected payments are certainly a risk. Factors are governed by Article 9 of the UCC code. So there are protections in place for factors and secured transactions, which is why that notification process, notifying for a factor to notify the account debtor that they own those receivables and that the payments need to come to them. Once a factor does that, and they can prove that they've done that, if the account debtor pays the client instead of paying the factor, they're subject to double payment liability, and the factor has recourse back to that account debtor, and that account debtor could have to pay for that invoice again direct to the factor. So there's a lot of protections there for the factor, but that's certainly one of the things that factors just kind of have built into their normal process, is to look for fraudulent invoices and to protect against misdirected payments. Obviously, I've talked a lot about dilution. Certainly, that's a big risk. And even looking at historical dilution and setting your advance rate at the rate that's kind of low enough to cover historical dilution with that reserve account is very important, but there could be other things that go wrong. I had a client that sold baby monitors to Target, and during COVID, Target changed their return policy that if you returned a baby monitor, which is kind of a highly returnable item, they would not restock it on the shelf because of COVID concerns. So any returns automatically got charged back to the client versus being restocked on the shelf, which caused dilution to go crazy, right? So monitoring the dilution, very important. The factor has the ability to reduce an advance rate whenever they want to, but that certainly is a risk. If a factor is advancing more to their factoring client than what the customer is going to repay, then that factor is owed money. You know, we talk about fraudulent invoices, and collusion kind of goes hand in hand with that. It has happened in factoring where sometimes the factoring client and someone at the account debtor are in collusion with each other. I had a client many, many years ago that was giving their friend in the account debtor kind of a kickback on the advances that we were giving them if they confirmed the invoices for them. So it was a real account debtor. It was a real business, but the invoices were not real. But even though we were verifying them and there was someone there saying, yes, those invoices are right, he was only saying that because his factoring client was, my factoring client was giving him some cash to do that. So that is a risk. There are a lot of ways to protect against that. But again, one of those kind of known risks that almost every factor has that risk and how to mitigate that risk built into their, to the way they do business. Account debtor insolvency, especially in a market like this, certainly is a risk to the factor. If it's, we talked earlier about recourse and non-recourse. If it's a non-recourse factoring arrangement and an account debtor files bankruptcy, the factor cannot go back to their client to collect that. If an account debtor files bankruptcy and it's full recourse, a factor can go back to their factoring client. But, you know, in most cases, that factoring client can't just pay the factor back for that. So something has to, some sort of repayment plan has to take place. A lot of factors, and I certainly have in my past, use a credit insurance policy where you can insure certain account debtors. So if there is some sort of event of insolvency that happens, you can file a claim on the insurance. But that is definitely a risk in factoring. Something that's become more of a risk recently and is a very hot topic in our industry is identity theft. And that's very popular in the transportation space, but certainly others see it as well, where some bad actors are stealing the identity of real trucking companies to kind of create this fake trucking company so they can factor receivables. And so that's something that people are looking out for. There's a lot of tools out there that can help identify identity theft, but that is certainly a risk that has become more and more prevalent recently. We talked about concentration risk. Again, if you have a client who has just a handful of account debtors or one account debtor, and something goes wrong with that one, it's much harder to collect out of that than if there are several account debtors that you're holding a reserve on that can help offset kind of one that does go bad. And then there are industry challenges. The transportation market is a very difficult market right now. Rates are down. It's just, there's a lot of challenges. Obviously during COVID, service industries like staffing and whatnot, became a very difficult industry because nobody was sending workers anywhere. So keeping up with the different industry challenges, and your client may be perfect and not be doing anything wrong. But then, you know, there's some sort of problem that happens in that industry that can impact the factor's ability to collect on the invoices. So not to scare you with all those risks, because there really are a lot of protections that factors have. It's kind of the fun part of factoring, because there are so many tools in a factor's toolbox to get repaid that it makes all of those risks very, very, very worth it. And historically, factoring write-offs are less than 1% annually. So, I thought it was important for you to understand what those risks are. If you choose to invest in a factoring company, those clients, that's the underlying collateral, those account debtors. But the protections really do work in the factor's favor. We have the Article 9 protection with the UCC that really helps to protect against misdirected payments by giving factors the ability to go back to an account debtor if they pay the factoring client instead of the factor. Factors always have a perfected priority security interest in at least the receivables. So the majority of factors are going to be in first position on those receivables. In a lot of cases, a factor has more than just the receivables. It's very common to file an all asset filing. So you're secured by all assets of the business, but needing a first position in the invoices has to happen. There are a lot of protections in the purchase and security agreement that factors use with their clients. Factors really do have the ability to do almost anything they need to do to get repaid by their client. It is very heavily weighted in the factor's favor, but it's like that because of the risks associated. And I've always felt that, if you've got a factoring prospect who's trying to negotiate how much you're charging for a misdirected payment fee, it's probably not a factoring prospect you want to turn into a client, because if they're worried about penalty fees for doing something wrong, that should be a little bit of a red flag. I mentioned earlier guarantees, those personal and validity guarantees certainly help. They come into play. Look, when a business owner knows that personally he's responsible or she's responsible for what happens in the business, there's a lot of weight in that. And a factor can go back on a personal guarantee, or in the case of fraud, a validity guarantee to collect direct, not just from the business, but from those guarantors. That cash reserve I've mentioned, the fact that factors do not advance 100% and that they hold a reserve is a huge protection for factors. When you hold a reserve, you can use that reserve, whether it's from one particular account debtor or a pool of account debtors, to help offset any sort of negative balance that a factor is owed. So those reserves are very important. The notice of assignment talked about, the Article 9 notifying those account debtors, huge protection. That sort of verifications, document auditing, you catch so much doing that before you even fund an invoice. So that's a huge protection. Collecting the payments direct from the account debtor, but calling on those collections, talking to accounts payable at those account debtors, you learn so much. And so that's certainly a big protection. And then having control of the cash, having everything come to your lockbox, or if you've got dominion over an existing lockbox that the business has, but having that dominion of cash is a huge, huge protection. So if you are looking to use your self-directed IRA to invest in a factoring company who's doing all of these things, who's an IFA member, what else should you look for? You want to look at their history, that factor's history. How much do they write off year over year, if anything? Have they been in business for a while? Are they concentrated in any one industry? If they're transportation only, you want to make sure that you really take time to understand the transportation industry before you choose that factor. If they're doing business with all industries, well, there's less concentration and reliance on any one industry. That may be a little bit of more of what you're looking for, to have the different concentration based off of industries. You want to look at their average write-offs. If they're writing off 10% a year, that may be outside of your risk tolerance. If they're writing off 1% a year, you may be very comfortable with that, but you really want to understand what that looks like historically. You want to understand what the experience of the management who's running that factoring company looks like. Have they been in factoring for a while? Are they a certified account executive in factoring? Or did they come from some totally different industry and aren't all that familiar with factoring? So you really want to understand who the key players are at the factor who are making those credit, underwriting, daily funding, portfolio management decisions. You want to understand the legal documents the factor is using to make sure that they've got protections in there to help cover all those risks we talked about. And you want to ask them questions about industry best practices. Are they auditing backup documentation before they fund an invoice? Are they calling to verify invoices before they fund? Are they collecting direct from the account debtor, or do they let their clients make those collection phone calls? You know, are they managing the cash or payments coming direct to them? So just to really understand if they're using all of those best practices that help offset the risk. And then you want to understand more about how they have been financing their factoring business up until this point, and make sure that they've got a proven track record of being able to manage those finance facilities. Why are they looking for an investor now? Have they just outgrown their current finance facilities? Are they trying to grow themselves and just need some additional cash? Or have they had some problems with their existing financing partner and that's why they're looking for someone else? So I think those are a lot of the things that you really want to focus on, amongst other things, but those are certainly some of the core things to look for in a factor. Okay, I know that was a lot of information in a short amount of time. And so here is my contact information. You are certainly welcome to reach out to me if you have any questions, obviously to Bill. But thank you for listening. And if there's any questions, I'm happy to answer.
Okay, I'm actually going to, before I get into my part of it, I have a quick question for you. So how would, you know, our the attendees or anybody who is interested in, you know, investing with a factoring company, how would they find them? How would you suggest that they, you know, hunt down and find a factoring company to potentially invest through?
So a great question. I think probably maybe getting involved in the IFA, coming to an event or so and meeting some folks. But certainly if someone is interested, Bill, I think, you know, let them reach out to you or to me and we can help maybe find some folks. People reach out to me all the time looking for additional capital options, liquidity options. And so if there's someone interested, let us know. And as we hear of those opportunities, I'm happy to share them. I think you, and correct me if I'm wrong, but may have some sort of platform that we could, you know, get some folks using that could help match up some people. But I do think, go to our website, look at our events. If you really are interested coming to an event, especially something like our annual conference, which is what Bill did earlier this year, is the best way to learn more about the industry and start to meet some of the key players, which is the best way to find folks to partner with.
Okay, so before we get to, again, I'm going to remind you to go ahead and ask your questions in the Q&A box, and we're going to answer them in the end. I'm going to take like 5 or so minutes here just to talk about how you could potentially invest in what essentially would be in a private company using your retirement account. So first of all, what is a self-directed IRA? It's two things, essentially. It's a retirement account in which you as the individual make all your own investment decisions. So Entrust is not a fiduciary. We don't provide advice. We don't sell investments. We don't recommend any particular asset. You make all your own investment decisions. So that's one of the main things. And the other part is you're not limited to just stocks, bonds, and mutual funds. Most people who have a retirement account, for everybody who has a retirement account, it's required to be held by a custodian, a financial services company who acts as custodian. So most people's custodian is a bank or brokerage firm, Merrill Lynch, Charles Schwab, Fidelity, companies like that. And those firms limit you to investing in stocks, bonds, and mutual funds. But the IRS doesn't limit you. The IRS says you can invest in almost anything you want inside a retirement account. You can invest in real estate, in private equity, in precious metals, in notes. And I mean, we had somebody invest in cattle inside a retirement account with us in a racehorse. You can invest in almost anything you want but you need a custodian who's willing to process and hold that investment. And that's where Entrust comes in. So we are the custodian. We're a financial services company. We provide all the same custodial services you get from Merrill Lynch, Charles Schwab, companies like that. From a reporting to the IRS standpoint, you have online access to your account. The difference between them and us is we will hold non-traditional assets. If you want to invest in things other than just stock, you know, publicly traded stocks, bonds, mutual funds, we will process and hold those investments. So there's essentially two different types of accounts that you can use. There are tax deferred accounts like traditional IRAs, SEP IRAs, 401ks, 403bs, pension plans. Those are all pre-tax accounts that grow tax deferred. When you take the money out, you have to pay taxes on the withdrawal. Then there's a Roth IRA, which is a post-tax contribution. So you don't get a tax deduction when you make the contribution, but the earnings grow tax-free as long as you've met the two qualifications of being over 59 and a half and having a Roth for at least 5 years. So a self-directed IRA is not a type of account. It's a description of the service. You still decide whether you want to self-direct your traditional or your Roth or your SEP or your 401k. We will hold all of those. We will custody all those types of accounts. And then you, by having your account with us, it's automatically a self-directed traditional or self-directed Roth or self-directed 401k because we're a self-directed custodian. That's the service that we provide. So how does it work? Pretty straightforward. Decide who you want to use as custodian. Choose the account type. And the account type is going to be driven by how you're funding that account. If you have an existing traditional IRA with another custodian, then you're probably going to open a traditional IRA with us, right? If it's a Roth, then it's going to go to a Roth. So you choose the custodian, you open your account, you fund the account. You can either transfer from an existing IRA, roll over from a 401k or any other employer-sponsored qualified plan, or you can make an annual contribution. And then you instruct the custodian to make the investment you want to make. So if you're going to, if you find a factoring company and they're raising capital or they're, you know, they're open to investors and you're going to invest with them, they're going to provide an investment agreement. You submit that to the custodian with your IRA listed as the name of the investor, right? So for me, if I was using my retirement account, the name of the investor that would go on the agreement would be the Entrust Group for benefit of, or we shortened FBO, the Entrust Group FBO, Bill Neville, account number 12345. That's the name of the investor, right? So you send the investment agreement to us, and then we send the money directly to the investment sponsor, to the company that you're investing in, or to the borrower if you're using notes, or to the seller if you're buying real estate, like all of these different things. But the key is it has to be in the name of the IRA. So any income that generates from that investment doesn't get paid to you. It gets paid directly to the IRA. So again, if you're factoring, if you're investing, that factor, when it pays out to their investors, is not going to pay to you. It's going to pay to the IRA because it's the IRA that made the investment. And then if you happen to make an investment for something that has expenses, like a piece of real estate, right? If you use your IRA to buy a rental property, then that property's property taxes, maintenance, insurance, the IRA will pay those expenses. You don't pay them because you don't own them. The IRA owns the investment. Okay. So that's it. We're going to get to the Q&A here. Just real quick, if you have any, at the end of this, you're going to get a brief survey. Feel free to please provide feedback. And if you want more information on self-directed IRAs or just different kinds of alternative assets, you can go to our website, which is theentrustgroup.com. And you can find all kinds of educational information, including this webinar will be up there. We have various articles and things about different types of investments and information about self-directed IRAs, specifically the Learning Center. All right, Q&A. Yeah, so we're going to leave that page up so you have both mine and Tanya's contact information. All right, so for the first question, it says, is there any minimum investment amount requirement to start? So for an IRA, for with us, there's no minimum. For factoring companies, Tanya, I mean, if your experience on the companies, they typically have a minimum that they're looking for.
No, right? I mean, there could be a factoring company that's looking for $100,000 and one that's looking for, 5 million, right? So no. And because the sizes of our membership are so broad, it could really run the gamut.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a general for any private equity investment, which is essentially what this would be, right? If somebody used their IRA to invest with a factoring company, that factoring company is either going to be probably bringing it in as, some kind of arrangement where it's an equity type thing, where if we get, 10%, 20% return, we'll give you 50%, or they could structure it as a note. But in either case, the investment is being done with that company, and it's up to that company, those factoring companies, to determine whether they have minimums or not. And I'm sure they have a minimum, right? But the minimum could, as you say, it can vary from as low to maybe $20,000 to as high as, $1 million of what they want from any single investor. And that's kind of standard operating procedure for private equity, fund companies that are raising capital from private investors.
And I'll just say as well, there could be some factors who are looking for investment in just one particular client relationship, and there will be some who are looking for investment in their overall portfolio, right? So it really could vary.
Sure. Okay. So you may have already sort of covered this, so you don't need to repeat yourself too much. It says best practice to minimize risks. How do we manage risks? What is the cost involved to deal with risk? Is there any example where we potentially lose principal? I mean, you kind of had that whole page associated with this, so I don't know if you want to expand on that at all, or if just sort of refer
No.
them back to that screen.
Yeah, I think we went over that earlier. I mean, that really are the core risks and mitigants.
The risk to the factoring company, right? I mean, in terms of, is there any example where we potentially lose principal as
If
an
the factor
investor in a
doesn't
factoring
collect,
company?
yeah, I mean, if the factor has a client that goes bad for any very, various reasons, and they're not able to be made whole on the amount that they advance them, there certainly that would trickle down to could trickle down to any investors.
The underlying investors. Yeah. Again, and that's any private equity investment is going to, potentially deal with that risk. What research needs to be done on existing liens and debts, and that could supersede a factor first position note? Well, the factor, that's not a note, right? So
Right.
factor
But
is.
factors, they do run searches, background searches, UCC searches. That's one of the first things that's done in underwriting. Any sort of existing liens are identified, whether that's tax liens, and tax liens are monitored on an ongoing basis because those are the only liens that can trump a first position filing. But if there are any sort of liens out there that are on in first position on the receivables, then either the factor will have to pay off that lender to release their lien from the proceeds of the first advance that they make, or enter into some sort of subordination or intercreditor with the party that has the priority lien. So the factor gets that priority lien in the receivables at least.
Next question, very specific. Is LSQ funding still in business?
So that's interesting because that's where I started my career and spent almost a decade at LSQ Funding. But yes, and they're a member.
Okay. This is, to some extent, this is probably asked maybe before I asked the question to you, but it says, how do you vet a factoring company that may not publish financials? How do you find a factoring company? And then it follows up with, how do you find a factoring company that takes investments from individuals and what their requirements are?
Yeah, so we did talk about that part, but the first part of the question, how do you vet? You make them give, if they want money, they need to give you some information, right? And so while the factor may not be public, it's commonplace when they're looking for investors of any sort, whether that's participants, a bank line, whatnot, that they're going to have to provide you with financial information. And if they're not willing to, it's probably not the right factor for you to partner with.
Yeah, and I'm going to reiterate what I said earlier in terms of we encourage anybody who's making investments to involve lawyers,
Of
financial
course.
advisors, people like that before making any investment. And that specifically when you're looking investing in private equity, right? And that could be, I mean, we're obviously talking about factoring companies, but that could involve there are companies out there that are essentially operating private funds where they raise capital and then maybe they'll go invest in a apartment complex, right? And it's going to be structured through an LLC. You're investing in that LLC. The same concept applies. Do your due diligence, have advisors, have legal people look over any documents before you make any investment.
I'll also just mention, Bill, there's a lot of consultants in the industry. And so if you really do want to get active and you're concerned that you don't know how to properly vet a factor, it's probably worth it to hire, a consultant or somebody to help you with that process so you're not flying blind.
Okay, are there penalties for breaches of the code of ethic of the code of ethics of the members of IFA? So this person has three questions in a row. So we'll do them one at a time. Are there penalties for breach of the code of ethics of the, I don't know why I'm having trouble with
For
that, members of
sure.
IFA?
If we get a complaint about a code of ethics, we obviously go to that factor, understand what's happening, give them the opportunity to resolve it. They resolve it, then we move on. If they continue to get the same complaint over and over and they don't resolve it, or there is a very serious complaint that they are not resolving, then we rescind their membership.
The follow-up question is there risk insurance for factors? You kind of talked about
Yeah,
again some
there's
of those.
credit insurance, which is pretty common. Risk insurance, this kind of like a fable. Some people have said they've had it, but I've never really seen a risk policy that really works. But credit insurance, is definitely a very popular piece.
Okay, and then the last question for that person is asking for security from factor clients a practice in the factoring industry?
Yes, you get a security interest, typically all assets, but at a minimum, first position on the receivables. But it is a factoring and security agreement, so you do get a security interest.
Okay, the next question, to some extent, we can probably both answer. Can a self-directed IRA engage in factoring? So I want to talk about just real quickly about when I was at the IFA event and I was asking a lot of questions and was one of the questions was around telling people is could a person simply be a factor, right? Like, is there a way for an individual to just simply be a factor and use their own personal funds? And they mentioned they knew of like one person who actually did something like that where they just, they just factored using their own money. Now, it seems like the 99% of the industry or 99 point something percent is factoring companies, right? So an IRA can certainly invest into a factoring company, assuming that company is looking to raise capital, right? That they are looking for investors. Could your IRA, self-directed IRA, be a factor? Could you find a company out there who needs capital and says, hey, we will accept your money and you can collect the receivables and do everything that the way Tanya described. Sure. Theoretically, you could. It doesn't sound like that would be a, first of all, you'd have to have factoring experience to do something like that. You'd have to know what you're doing, right? But I mean, yes, the answer to your question is could a self-directed IRA be like engage in factoring, be a factor? Absolutely, right? But you have to know what you're doing, right? Otherwise, like what this is really geared towards explaining how factoring works is going to be you're probably going to want to find a company that's already doing factoring who is raising capital, who is looking for investors that they could turn around and take your funds and they factor it and they handle all of that and then they pay a return on investment back to your IRA. Tanya, if you want to expand on that.
No, I agree with you 100%. I think a factoring is not easy, and so you definitely want to partner with someone who knows what they're doing.
Okay, so next question is what is the best place to view factoring investment opportunities on platform with Entrust or via the International Factoring Association? I'll answer my end on this first. If you're an Entrust account holder, you do have access. We have a thing called Entrust Connect, where we have a list of investment sponsors that other Entrust clients have invested in. At the moment, we don't have any factoring companies that are listed on Entrust Connect. That would be the only possible way that you would potentially be able to do it is at some point in the future, if we find ourselves developing a relationship with factoring companies who are referring investors to us, or we get an existing entrust client, like maybe somebody who's attending this who finds a factoring company and then invests, we can potentially list that company on Entrust Connect because they have at least one Entrust account holder that's invested. We don't currently have any with them. I'll let Tanya answer as far as the IFA end of things.
Yeah, I mean, I would say if you are actively interested, shoot me a message and let me know. And certainly as I hear of opportunities, I'm happy to connect you. But I really do think the best way to do it, if you genuinely want to get involved and learn more and meet folks, is to come to an IFA event and start to do that. And you know, Bill knows it doesn't take much to start to meet people and to hear of what opportunities are out there. And that's really the best way to do it.
Yeah. And you guys have, I mean, I went to the main event, right? Like the big one. You guys have some smaller ones, right? Like where it's like just for the factoring in the transportation space and
Correct.
Like some little bit more niche-y ones as well.
We do. Right? We do.
How many members are in the IFA?
Yeah, we've got about just over 450 corporate members. So the factoring companies are our members, not any individuals. And then we also have members like the Entrust Group who are providers and supporters of the industry through our ally membership.
Is there a publicly traded funding factoring company?
There is. There's a couple of bank-owned ones, you know, that certainly are public and publicly traded. I would suggest you Google those and come up. I'm not sure that I can really say who they are, but there definitely is.
Just as we have credit rating and credit scores, is there a rating for factoring companies?
There is not. There's so many variables. There's no real way to kind of rate them in that way. So no, other than their financial information.
Okay. And last question, where is the annual IFA conference held? Last year was in Miami.
Yeah. This year was our conference at the Fountain
or
Blue
this
in
year,
Miami.
I mean.
Yeah. For 2025, it's in Palm Desert, California.
Okay. Tanya, that was the last question. Really,
okay.
Really interesting stuff. Enjoyed the presentation tremendously.
Thank
you for taking the time to
educate
our people. And for anybody who's still attending, there's her contact information and there's mine as well if you have questions about self-directed IRAs. Tanya, again, thank you. Everybody who joined, thank you as well.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me. Bye.